We've left off in Revelation chapter 21. We almost finished up with verse 5 last week, so it may be good to go back and read Revelation 21, 4 and 5. If you've been in the recent classes, you may remember that as we look at this chapter, as well as the next, we are, at least for the sake of this class, looking at the material primarily from the standpoint that it describes the New Testament church and not heaven. So when you look at 21:4, where John says, "Shall wipe away every tear," no doubt that that's true in eternity. But here the idea seems to be a spiritual application in the spiritual realm. Christ has come, sin's been fully addressed, and that spiritual sorrow, people, as Jesus described in the Sermon on the Mount, they're no longer mourning over their sins. He said, "Blessed are they that mourn, they shall be comforted." Death shall be no more. He's taken a spiritual death out of the way. Again, mourning, crying, pain, those spiritual issues that man dealt with. We sometimes have readings from the book of Hebrews that talks about the remembrance of sins. The conscience of the worshipers could not be cleansed and so forth. But with Christ, with the New Testament, the first things, the Old Testament system, that's all been taken away. So John says it's passed away, it's been removed. Then in verse 5, he says, "And he that sits on the throne said, Behold, I make all things new." We related that to 2 Corinthians chapter 5. Remember where Paul said, if any man is in Christ, he is what kind of creature? He's a new creature. The old things are passed away. Behold, all things have become new. So again, lines up very, very well. And he saith, "Right, for these words are faithful and true." And that's where we ended last week. I think it's interesting when you look at what we have here and you continue to go through this material and you look back in some of John's writings, 1 John and even the book of John, you begin to see a lot of things that are parallels, things that just kind of build off one another. Remember back in the book of John, chapter 18, verse 38, Pilate asked a question. Jesus, just prior to the time when he went to the cross, was there before Pilate. And Pilate said, "What is truth?" Remember that question? What's truth? Well, don't we have an answer to that question now? Same writer. That question is recorded in John. Now the same author over here in Revelation 21, verse 5. Does he give us information? Does he offer any insight as far as what truth is? God says, "I am faithful and I'm truth." Well, when we think about truth, what is it? It's information from God. That's truth. Truth is not what we think. Truth is not what we feel. Truth is not what we may prefer to hear. Truth is information from God. Thus, the idea that there is my truth and there is your truth and we have other truth out there and it just kind of depends on who we are and where we live and our circumstances, that's simply not true. And then you also have, I think here as you look at ahead a little bit, as we look at verse 6, and that's going to be new material for us, you can see some additional things that come from the book of John. "And he said unto him, They are come to pass. I am the Alpha, the Omega, the beginning and the end. I will give unto him that is athirst of the fountain of the water of life freely." Okay, as you start looking at this information, Jesus is identified as the Alpha and the Omega. We have that description applied to him in the first chapter of the book, Revelation chapter 1, verse 8. It's also applied to him in the last chapter of the book, Revelation 22, verse 13. And we've, in previous classes, defined Alpha and Omega. What's Alpha? The beginning. That was the first letter in the Greek alphabet. Omega refers to the end. That would be, it's kind of like A to Z, but this would be the Greek alphabet. Instead of A to Z English, it would be Alpha equivalent to the A. Omega would be equivalent to the Z. All right, now somebody says today, A to Z, we've covered this A to Z. We've looked at this. A to Z, what are we saying? Complete. All right, it's complete, it's thorough, nothing is lacking. When Jesus says, "I'm the Alpha and the Omega," what's he affirming? All right, that would be one of the points that we would make. He's complete? All right, he's also saying, "I'm eternal." When you say A to Z, there was nothing before me, there's not going to be anything after me. Thus, when you have people today who say Jesus is a created being, Jehovah's Witnesses would say that he's the most prominent created being, this expression would say that is simply not true. He's always been, he is an eternal being. And as we think about Jesus, as far as a member of the Godhead, what is his primary role? His primary function? Luke 19:10. "For the Son of Man came to do what? To seek and save that which was lost." What was Jesus' primary function? To save man from sin, right? If Jesus is the Alpha and the Omega, and he's also man's redeemer, how fully does he redeem man? All right, there's nothing lacking as far as Christ and the sacrifice. He has done everything that literally can be done, needs to be done, could be done to bring people back from the state of sin. He's the originator and the finisher of man's redemption. Then as we look at verse 6, we have some other things that come to our attention. John talks about water, but this is a very specific kind of water. Well, let me toss in one other thing before we get to that. At the beginning of verse 6, he says, they are come to pass. Now, thinking about John and the book of John, another book he wrote, anything in the book of John sound a little similar to that? They're come to pass. Talking about Jesus, redemption, the author, the finisher of our faith, they are come to pass. Jesus is on the cross. Remember that short statement? Depending on the translation, it's finished, it's done, it's completed, those kinds of things. Again, you can kind of see where apparently John's mind was. Thinking about Christ, the Alpha and the Omega, maybe his mind is going back there to those very words that were spoken by Jesus on the cross. It's done, it's finished. Well, he comes back to that idea here. Thus, as we look at the book of Revelation, we, as we've said several times before, we have really a restatement many times of what we find elsewhere in the New Testament. Then we come, Revelation 21, verse 6, to this water. And John says it's the water of life. We've asked this question before. We've made this point before. A lot of people, I think, have the idea that we're going to somehow be, you know, sipping water in eternity, or we're going to be kneeling down at some kind of brook. I do not believe that that's right. If you skip back a little bit, one of the things that we've said about Revelation is that John goes through information and it goes back and there's a recapitulation. He'll talk about the same things again. And we've also made the point that in this book, just like 1 John, you have contrasts. You can follow the ways of the world, you can be a child of the devil, or you can follow the ways of God and be a child of light. Think about this expression, Revelation 21, verse 6, the water of life. And let's just back up a couple pages. Let's look first at Revelation 17. Early in the chapter, we have this, Revelation 17, verse 4. And the woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet and decked with gold and precious stones and pearls, having in her hand a golden cup. What do you use a cup for?
Drink.
To drink. All right, and in her cup you can drink what? Revelation 7:4. You can drink the cup of abominations. That's a big word that means what? Sin. You can drink, you can be involved with the ways of the world. Or the contrasting choice is what? Revelation 21:6. You can have the water of life. Well, that's not going to be something people do in eternity. It's something that people do now. And then if you look across the page, Revelation chapter 18, verse 3. For by the wine of thy wrath of a fornication, there again, you have the same kind of thing. They're involved, the image of drinking, the idea of a cup there, and so forth. So you have here in Revelation 21, the New Testament church has been established. It's come down from heaven. Revelation 21, verse 2. We'll also see this point coming forward again. I think it's in verse 10. Yeah, New Jerusalem coming down out of heaven from God. The church is of divine origin. It's not something that man created. It's not something that man originated. It's from God. And it offers this water of life throughout the Christian era. And if we do that, then as we talked about in verse 4, the problems associated with sin, the guilt of sin, the pain of sin, the tears associated with sin, God says, I can take those away by the New Testament that I've given to my son. And really, it's not any different than what we find elsewhere in the New Testament. We have mentioned a few times, John 4, remember the woman at Samaria? She's thinking about water, and Jesus said, if you use the water that I have, you're never going to what again? You're never going to thirst. So again, we've seen this stuff elsewhere in the New Testament. But John, as he comes to it, especially in the final two chapters of Revelation, he brings to mind these same things, only he uses a lot of symbolic language and some very, very powerful image. Jesus, even in the Sermon on the Mount, lays some groundwork for it. Blessed are they that hunger and thirst. Well, if you're that thirsty, what do you want? You want the water of life. Blessed are they that hunger and thirst, for they shall be filled. Those spiritual needs are going to be met. Revelation 21, verse 4. As far as no more hunger and no more thirst and pain and death and so forth. So really, information that is very, very good news now for us. And then let's have somebody head back to the Old Testament for just a second. Isaiah chapter 55, verse 1, and you have a minute to get there. Who wants to take care of that for us? All right, Bonnie. Now, as she's headed back there, I want to think about another of the key words that we have here in Revelation 21, verse 6. John says at the end of the verse, he that's athirst, you can partake of the fountain of the water of life, and you can partake of it how? You can partake of it freely. Anytime you ever wanted something and a person said limit one, you know, you go into Sam's and maybe they have sample day and they're passing it and you think, boy, that's really good. Or that juice is really tasty. They're not going to let you walk out with a whole container of juice. They're not going to let you walk out with all the beef jerky or candy bar or protein bar or whatever they have. I mean, this is a sample. But God says when it comes to the water of life, spiritual refreshment, how much can you have? All you want. There's no limitation. All right, now let's look at that passage in Isaiah. Bonnie, Isaiah 55 verse 1. Oh, no, I'm sorry. Isaiah 55. Now, remember, as we look at Isaiah, we've talked before, first 29 chapters, a lot of things about the Hebrew people. But when you look, or first 39 chapters, when you look at the last 27 chapters, you have a lot of messianic material. So this is going to be in that messianic section. Isaiah 55, verse 1. Okay, now this is interesting. Again, it's in the messianic section of Isaiah. And Isaiah says, not only come, but who's eligible to come?
Everyone.
Yeah, and he's very specific with that. He says, even if you are poor, you don't have any money, you can come. Wow, what a great invitation. And doesn't that line up real well with something that John wrote in the third chapter of the book called John? For God so loved the world that... Yeah, but whosoever. Rich, can they come? Yeah. What about the poor? The person who's so poor he has no money. Yeah, great news. So Isaiah looked forward to that. John talks about that, John 3:16. And now we see in Revelation chapter 21 the same kind of thing. Whoever it is that's athirst... you may not have anything as far as material resources, but the fountain of life is available. It's open freely, and each one can come. One other quick point, and then I'll say a couple other things, and then we'll look at verses 7 and 8. As you see the contrast here in Revelation 21, with drinking the bad stuff, the cup of abomination, Revelation 17, and the cup of life that is going to lead to that wrath of God, Revelation chapter 18, verses 3 and 4. Don't you begin to see the message that Jesus taught in the Sermon on the Mount? He said there are too many, there are how many roads?
Two.
And he said one of those roads is the broad, the wide, the way that's easy to get on and stay on. And he said the other way is the narrow way. Well, when you think about the water of life that we can partake of freely, which way is that? Is that the broad way or is that the narrow way? That's the narrow way. And that cup of abominations, Revelation 17, that is the Broadway. So again, this is the same information that we've been exposed to for years, but now it's being presented in language that may be somewhat unfamiliar to us. All right, then we talked about the fact that saying God's plan is done, verse 6, or come to pass, I think is the King James translation. You have, again, what we had in John 19, verse 30, but there is this additional point. If you followed along when I read that closely, you'll see it varies a little bit. And he said unto me, they are come to pass. Instead of the pronoun they, anybody have anything different?
Which verse are you talking about?
Verse 6, Revelation 21. They are come to pass. All right, it's done. Was there a difference between they and it as far as the number being described? It means how many?
One.
They means how many? All right, at least two. We've got multiple. Several are involved there. So it's interesting that the translation varies a little bit. It is plural in the Greek text, which that is not usually how most translations render this. But I think you can still see the point either way. When you think about redemption, can you look at it as a single act? You know, God came to save the world, okay? But when you think about redemption from another perspective, were not many things involved? Jesus couldn't have gone to the cross if he had not first... All right, he had to first come. So there was a process there. So when he talks about it's finished or these things are done, it's a way of describing God's entire plan of redemption. And that's good news. And that allows us to have this water of life and to have it freely and allows for God to make all things new. One other quick thought. Based on everything that's been said, we've got the church coming down from heaven, verses 2 and 10. God has gone through and done all things necessary to make salvation possible for man. He's created this special spiritual institution for people. What if an individual comes along and says, you know, I want to create my own church. I'd prefer a religion that doesn't have Christ at the head. If you were God and you did all the stuff that we're reading about in Revelation 21, how would you feel? I would think this person is not worth anything to me. This person is abominable because you have rejected the greatest thing that I have done for humanity. But a lot of people never get to that point. But if they would really study, I think, Revelation 21 and 22, and begin to see the great value of the church. And we're going to see that a little later in the chapter as John talks about these precious stones and some other things. You know, he gives a vision of the church, if you will, in symbolic terms to say this is really the most valuable thing that people will ever be exposed to in life. And yet, and I'm going to make this point again, likely not today, several folks, as they look at the church, what's their view of it? That's exactly right. We don't need it. It's not necessary. One church is as good as another. We can live a fine Christian life without it and those kinds of things. But God has, Hebrews 10 verse 20, the text there says he's given us a new and living way. If we reject that living way, if we reject that new way, he's going to reject us. Thoughts that you want to add or ask before we pick up with Revelation 21, 7 and 8?
Right. Going on along with what you said in the past, back in Revelation the 7th chapter also, verse 7.
Yes.
Yes,
you have it. And Revelation 7, which you guys weren't here when we were going through that material, but Revelation 7 and 21, you have the same things being discussed. And that's another way of saying, as we talked about before, John deals with some things, goes back, sets it aside for a little bit, and he keeps coming back to the same items. But you do have that, where he talks about the 12 tribes and the glory and the 144,000 and all that stuff. So if you miss it the first time, you now get a second shot at it. But you're exactly correct in that. Anybody else? Okay. Let's pick up then 7 and 8, and these verses are probably a little bit better known to people than some others. He that overcomes shall inherit these things, and I will be his God, and he shall be my son. But for the fearful and unbelieving and abominable and murderers and fornicators and sorcerers and idolaters and all liars, your part shall be in the lake that burneth with fire and brimstone, which is the second death. All right, now we've talked about in previous classes the word overcomer. This is a word that John uses. We find this word being used in the book of 1 John as well. And who's an overcomer? Book of Revelation, book of 1 John. Who's the overcomer?
Christians.
All right. We've only got two choices. It's going to be the saved or the unsaved. And obviously it's not going to be the unsaved. So here's the person who is trying to live the faithful Christian life throughout the Christian dispensation. Now back in Revelation 2 and 3, I'm not turning back there, but back in Revelation 2 and 3, John talks about the seven churches. And as he writes to the seven churches, you will see again and again the idea in those books of being an overcomer. And various promises are made to the overcomers. Well, now as we talk about faithful Christians, towards the end of the book, what's the basic promise here? He that overcomes, the person who's going to live the faithful Christian life, what's going to happen to him? All right, he's going to inherit some things. He's going to receive some good things in this life. Those blessings that we talked about, for example, back in verse 4. There will also be that eternal inheritance. It's interesting, I'm not sure why John only used the word inherit here in the book of Revelation. But we do, as we look at the Bible, see the idea of an inheritance in other passages. Paul probably was the most prominent writer to talk about an inheritance back in Romans 8, verse 17. Also in the book of Galatians, chapter 4, verse 7, he used the idea of inheritance. And in the ancient world, and even in our time, you know, people are familiar with the idea of an inheritance. You have family members, you know, especially in this country, they've lived for a long time. Maybe there's some insurance money. They've accumulated some material goods. And then, at least in many cases, what the parents have received, what relatives have received at the time of their death, or maybe sometime prior to their death, they will begin to go ahead and offer an inheritance, or an inheritance will be left for their family members. As you go back and you look at this inheritance, this is the only place where I found it. I did some checking again this morning and thinking through some of these things one more time. But back in Matthew 5, verse 12, Jesus, as he talked about persecution, he said, what kind of reward are you going to have in heaven? Do you remember? Remember how he modified that word reward? For blank is your reward in heaven. For great. Talking about persecution. Well, I'm not sure that that's limited to just persecution as far as the greatness of the reward. But when God says, I've got a great reward for you, What kind of reward do you think that's going to be? Anybody ever been disappointed with a reward? Somebody says, we're going to give a reward to you if you find our dog. We're going to give a reward to you if you can help me find this earring, this piece of jewelry. And you found it. What kind of reward did you get? Here's a quarter. Here's a dollar. Well, you know, I don't consider that. I mean, I'm glad that the person got the thing back. I really didn't need or want paid for it. But that's not really, in our mind, a great reward, is it? Here's a buck for helping me find my puppy. You know, when we think a great reward, what are we thinking?
$100.
All right. You know, something that there's going to be some substantial value to. And in that particular case, I think, yeah, we would say that that's going to be a substantial reward. But when God says this is going to be great, the one who's created all things, whatever that's going to be, it will be great. Okay, so we've talked about the saved. They've got those spiritual blessings, verse 7. They're people who have partaken of the water of life. Well, if John's going to stay true to form, remember, you have a series of contrasts in this book. If he's talked about the saved for a while, then logically it would make some sense now to flip over and talk about who?
Unsaved.
The unsaved. Well, what do we find in verse 8? Would you say here's information about the saved or information about the unsaved? Sorcerers, idolaters, all liars. Lake of fire. Well, again, that would be associated with the unsaved, the unrighteous. John, as he lists the sins in this verse, we know that the people who are involved with sin, they're not forgiven. Paul said in Romans 6:23, the wages of sin is going to bring forth death and so forth. How does the list begin in verse 8? Okay. Yes, you have the contrast there, right? So it's a way of saying, look, guys, we're kind of flipping over to this different page. So there's a contrast.
First sin is cowardly.
Yes. We've got the idea of people who are cowards, people who are fearful, people who are unbelieving. And then as you get down to the list, he's talking about all liars. Quick question. Do you think that this is just kind of an arbitrary list of sins? John thought, well, okay, let's see. I'm going to, you know, maybe preach this information. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. These look like good sins. I'll just stick them there. Think it's arbitrary, or you think he may have had a purpose in mind? I suspect there was a purpose. And if we go back and we think about the people that were receiving this book, a lot of them were in a position where, what was the great temptation? Why might John start off with things like fear, cowards, and then end with the idea of lying?
Because they were being oppressed.
Yes. And where was that oppression coming from? All right. The government, in that day and time, remember we talked about the beast worship back in Revelation chapter 13? You're not willing to follow the beast, what's going to happen to you? You're going to suffer. You might not be able to buy, sell, trade, and so forth. You might die, all of those things. So there were certainly some other things. You know, murder, you can associate that with the first century and so forth. But there does seem to be a direct connection between the people who received this book and the sins that we're talking about here. And you also begin, I think, again, to see the contrast. John, as he talks about the holy city, comes down from Jerusalem. He's also talked about, if you will, the sinful city, the ways of the world, earlier in the chapters. Revelation 21, verse 8 is probably the best known passage in the book as far as this list of sins. But if you skip across the page, Revelation 22, verse 15, you'll find there a passage which is, when you compare to Revelation 21, 8, almost never mentioned. Everybody seems to go over Revelation 21:8, but 22:15 says, without, that is outside the church, are the dogs and the sorcerers and the fornicators and the murderers and the idolaters and everyone that loveth and maketh a lie. And I'm not sure why Revelation 21:8 has become so popular, but it just seems to be that if you're going to talk about lying, they almost forget, like 22:15 is in the book, but they will go over to Revelation 21, verse 8. All right, I want to go through the sins. In 21:8, for a couple of reasons, and I'll try to make those clear as we go through them, but is there, at this point, anything that you want to add or ask? Glenda?
Mine says that loves and practices falsehood.
Okay, so there again, that would be, was that the third one?
The last one.
Oh, are we talking about 21:15 or 22:15? Okay, so it doesn't use the word liar, and maybe that's one of the reasons why people would be less inclined to use that passage. But it's essentially the same information that we have in 21:8. There have been some songs. Anybody remember children's songs about Revelation 21:8? It's been about 25 years since I heard them. But I remember we had a young married couple, and maybe the husband lied. because we were in the same apartment complex, and boy, she just come over and sing that song, and I can't quite get the tune to sing it this morning, but anyway, somebody come up with a hymn about Revelation 21:8, but 22:15 wasn't part of that. Anybody else before we start going through the sentence? Right?
Over in Acts 20 chapter, now verse 38, it talks about God is able to give us the inheritance among those who are saved.
Yes. Right, so there again, you have the idea of an inheritance coming up, and God has that. Peter talked about that too. I think it's 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 4, where you've got that eternal, let's just take a quick look there. Doesn't fade away, reserved in heaven. Yeah, 1 Peter 1, 4, under an inheritance. There's that word again. He says it's incorruptible, undefiled, fades not away, reserved in heaven for you. So you have multiple passages in the Bible which talk about that inheritance, and they present it in a very positive way. Okay, let's go back and look at some of the specific sins here. We do have various lists of sins in the New Testament. Romans 1, you may remember Galatians 5, verses 19 through 21. Now the works of the flesh are manifest, which are these, Galatians 5. So John, just like Paul, was able to offer a contrast between the lives of Christians and non-Christians. But as we said, it seems like the sins listed here in Revelation 21:8 can be specifically related to emperor worship. God knows that his people are going to be tempted. He knows that his people can be put into some very difficult positions at times. So he also warns people, be careful, be cautious, because these are things that you can face. And if you are put in some severe situations, remember that statement back in Revelation 2, verse 10. Be faithful even to the point of death. So regardless of what the world throws at you, it might be hard, it might be very difficult, but you do your very best to stay the course. Regardless. Now, as we've already hinted, the word fearful, the first sin, we can relate that to in the first century, probably the emperor worship. There were people who were told, we're going to kill you, we're going to kill your family, you're going to lose your job unless you renounce Christ, or you can still follow Christ, and you need to perhaps serve the emperor as well if you want to get along with this. Well, this is not a new message. As we think about spiritual cowards, if you will, didn't Jesus cover that? Everyone therefore, Matthew 10:32, everyone therefore who shall do what? Who shall confess me before men, him will I also confess before my Father who's in heaven. But then in verse 33 of Matthew 10, whosoever shall deny me. Well, if you are denying Christ, are you a spiritual coward? Well, yes. So John picks up on this same theme, the same sin, and the idea being expressed here, but it's just worded in a slightly different way. And you may remember, too, in John 12, verse 42, nevertheless, even of the rulers, many believed on him. But because of the religious folks, people like the Pharisees, they would not confess it, lest they should be put out of the synagogue. So here again was a case where people believed. They had faith, they had confidence in the Lord, but they would not confess Christ. So when we think about the true Christian, it's someone who seeks to stand up for Christ and then does their best not to deny him. Now, let me ask a couple things about that. Someone says, well, okay, I understand the idea of being a spiritual coward. Does that mean that a Christian would never be afraid?
No.
No, I don't think so. Let's look at that in physical terms. Do you think there are some courageous people or people who have done some courageous things who had to face fear? If you're over there in Iraq or Afghanistan and you're involved in a military battle, you're pulling somebody off the battlefield, and you are awarded at a later time a medal that is somehow associated with your bravery, with your courage, you think you had some fear? Unless the guy had lost all of his, nuts and bolts, he probably was a little terrified. But he thought, that's my buddy, or this is the right thing to do. And, maybe got headed in that direction and decided I need to see it through. So when you think about courage, in a lot of cases, some of the most courageous people, some of the most courageous acts, have had fear going on inside the person as the activity was being done. So if you've ever wondered about fear, is it a sin? Not necessarily. The problem is not so much fear. The problem is fear that does what to you?
Makes you the coward.
It makes you the coward. You stop. That's where the problem is. But a lot of times, people say, well, I was afraid to talk to him. I was afraid to say something to her, but I did. And hopefully that situation worked out well. So there was that concern. In Acts chapter 18, even Paul, we find in Acts 18, verse 9, he was there in the area of Corinth, and God said to him in the Greek text, literally says, stop fearing. God says, I've got much people in the city. So Paul, you go ahead and preach. It's going to be okay. I know that you're afraid, but you have to put that aside. So do not think, well, I'm afraid in this situation and God's going to punish me. I'm going to go to hell. Those kinds of things. That's not the point. But the people who are that spiritual coward, and we'll say a little bit more about this a little later, and that's not just one time, but that's a pattern of life, if you will. God says, you're on the side of the unsaved. Anything that you want to add or ask about that sin? Sherman?
Okay, I understand that denying God, God or Jesus, right, would be a coward. But there's many people that are scared to knock on doors, scared to open up the Bible story, even scared to even talk about Jesus. Is that going to sin category?
I would say no, because I have said before, and I've done it here, and I don't know that I'm going to say I'm fearful. I suppose that was true 20 years ago. I'm not a song leader. I'd just about rather take a licking than be a song leader. But I'll tell you, there was a time in my life where I was afraid to lead singing. Now, I would knock on a door and do a lot of other things, but that just was not my thing, and it's still not my thing. You might find some Christians who are comfortable with doing every single thing. But I'm going to think that those people are rare birds. And it's just like any other relationship. For example, we might be one of the best employees that a company has. But there are some things where we just say, I don't want to touch that because I'm not good at it, or I may mess it up, or this, that, or the other reason. So when we, for example, think about the people with talents, there are going to be some areas wherein we're strong. And that would be how I would begin to really relate this. You know, you have certain abilities for God, and if you want to just say, well, I'm not going to use those for this reason and that reason. And hopefully we can extend those, expand those with time. But when you have, to use your specific illustration, somebody who says, we're going to have a campaign, we're going to knock on doors, I'm not comfortable with that, I'm not going to do that. Well, okay, but are there not some other things that you could do? Couldn't you provide transportation? Could you come up with the maps that we need in advance to, coordinate that effort? Could you house the people? Could you provide food? You know, a number of different things. But if you've got a person who's across the board that is that spiritual coward, then I'd say it qualifies.
Those are my exact same thoughts.
Okay. Well, that's why I say we want to go through these one by one rather than just say, here's a list, and people maybe continue to think some things about what's said here that are inconsistent with the text. So we're going to, like I say, go through all eight. Anybody else? All right, so we've taken care of the spiritual cowards. Who's next?
Unbelieving.
All right, the unbelieving people. Now, as you see that word initially, who might you associate it with? Who are the unbelievers? All right, we would think the atheist, the person who for whatever reason does not have faith in Christ. And John, again, the same fellow who wrote this book, talked about in John 3, verse 18, after he talks about John 3:16, everybody's invited, if you will, to become a Christian. He talks about in John 3:18 the people who rejected the light, who rejected Christ, and they're in a state of condemnation. So certainly the unbelievers in that sense would be included here. Who else, though? Might you be able to expand this a bit and say the unbelievers would include some other folks as well?
Other people that were not members of the church. They didn't believe the, all right, the new message. First starting with the Jews, and along with what Sherman said in your response, would you ask that question again that you asked him?
Sure. I said I can see where if you deny Jesus, you would be a coward. You know, like if someone, if I'm a Christian and someone came up to me, do you believe in Jesus, blah, 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 and I'm scared to see you. I could say, yeah, that would be a coward. But then I kind of said, what about the ones that are scared to knock on doors, scared to open up a Bible study or do something? I know that's what we should do. We should bring others to Christ. That's our job as Christians. But I was just asking,
if there's, if there are 10 things that you could do for Christ, for example, and this person says, I'm not comfortable doing this one, I will do the other 9. Does that then mean that you're a spiritual coward?
But the work of the church is to spread the gospel,
yes,
and evangelism. And it's because we're unlearned, untaught, we don't study, that puts us in that situation. So
yeah.
Myself included, ready to do more of that than what's being done now and get off our duffs. But then, that comes through
There is a progression in the Christian life. And if it's the old adage, if you're not going forward, you're going backwards. I'm not sure that that's always literally true, but there's, at least generally, I think that's a pretty good statement. And if you have people that become a Christian and they're content to just kind of go into the idle mode, and we're going to say more about that as we look at the second sin of unbelief, then that's a problem. Because, you know, Peter said grow. Grow in the grace and knowledge of Christ. Second Peter, I think 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 18. And that is a very explicit command. And if people are not doing that, then things like spiritual cowardice is going to set in and so forth. Sherman, did you?
There are other outlets for people to teach Christ in this world. Bible school, there's studies that you can mail to one another. You know, door knocking is not the only way to do it.
Yeah.
I've done door knocking. It doesn't bother me a lot, but I'll tell you what, there's some people, just to go to that door just makes them shake their boots. That doesn't make them a coward.
Yeah. Well, I've had people over the years, I've tried to vary this some. Dolores, we can share a story or two there, but she'd be one. But if you're going to go out in a Bible study, I don't need you to conduct the Bible study. I mean, if you want to, that's perfectly fine by me. But generally, I try to have a second person with me. And the only thing I need you to do is sit there. Now, maybe it would be helpful to have you aid the person in finding some Bible references, or if you want to contribute something, maybe you're seeing something that I'm missing. You know, all those things would be perfectly fine. But all you need to do is willing to come. You know, I will say what needs to be said if you don't want to say anything, and you just be literally that silent partner. And most people, I think, they may take a little coaxing, but most people are willing to do that. But for the person who says, I'm just afraid to come, you know, again, you have to think, well, you need a little aid to move you along a little bit, because you should be able to at least come with somebody. I mean, we're not going to have a knockdown drag out. Nobody's going to bring out a gun or a knife or anything like that. So you're going to come intact, and you're going to go home intact. So you can come. And over the years, I've never had anybody say, no, I'm too afraid to go. But as you mentioned, there may be some situations where they would say, I'm not comfortable doing this particular part of it. And again, there's just a comfort level there. That's not a matter of being a coward. Let's take Benny. No. Again, pulling from my personal experience, I have said at multiple times my family was not a religious family. We went to a Presbyterian church about twice a year, Easter and Christmas time. That religious group was where I was a Boy Scout. And, you know, Mom wanted to have me go through the confirmation class and whatnot, and that just seemed like a big waste of time for me. But because we were quote-unquote members there, they assigned us to pass the communion one day. And I can still remember, as a young person, about 14, I was absolutely terrified. I had no idea what the juice was. You know, for all I knew, it was the blood of Christ. Who wants to spill the blood of Christ? And what happens if you trip? You know, again, being completely unfamiliar with the religious group, it was really the fear of the unknown. You know, if this happens, if that happens, what do you do? What can happen? What are the repercussions? I simply didn't know. Now, if I were asked today to help with the Lord's table, and I've done that on a few occasions, not often, I have no difficulty with that. I mean, if somebody spilled the bread or spilled the grape juice, I think that, you know, we could get through that without any kind of difficulty, and that wouldn't scar me for life. But, you know, at the age of 14, that was terrifying to me. Well, think about that in relation to what we said in 2 Peter 3:18. Grow. Nobody should have the expectation that when somebody first becomes a Christian, we've got it all figured out. And we're going to be spiritually confident in every area. But as the years go by, those things that we're not comfortable with, we become more comfortable with, or maybe very comfortable with. And those things that we might not have been willing to do, maybe door knocking, when we were 20, now at the age of 50 or 60 or 70, we say we're willing to do. But there is that growth process there. But that's not really what John is talking about here. Remember the context of the book. You have some people, they're put into a position, are you a Christian? Remember Peter, wasn't he a spiritual coward at one point in his life? Do you know the man?
No.
Yeah, three times. And then the Bible also says Peter began to curse and swear. And again, he wasn't saying four-letter words, but he was saying, he was calling down curses on himself. You know, may God strike me dead if I'm failing to tell the truth. I swear in my mother's grave, I swear in the Bible. Those kinds of modern statements were what he was saying. Well, he was a spiritual coward. And John says, if you are going to do that, which is denying Christ, Matthew 10:33, if you're going to live in that way, you're not going to be saved. And again, if a person is new and they have a few situations in life where that comes up, but you know, that's one thing. But we're not talking about that. We're talking about that pattern of life. Okay.
You mentioned Peter, the denial of things. You said he was a coward. Well, that also ties right in. At that point in his life, he was on believing. He had left faith. Mm-hmm. He was not trustworthy.
Yes. Yeah, and there you're bringing me to the next point, which I kind of hope we could at least get into that. When we have, for example, spiritual cowards, we then see a related sin, which is this unbelief. And as some said, you know, atheism could be there. The religious groups that are not following the New Testament as the Bible describes. But you also, when you think about unbelief, would you not associate that with someone who is not really committed to Christ? If you believe that Jesus is the Christ, he is the only one who can get you to heaven, then what do you say to Christ? I mean, what did he say in Matthew 6:33? Seek ye first. Well, what does that say about your commitment to Christ? He's got to be that number one rock in the life. I mean, he's got to take first priority in everything. Now, if you put him and his cause, second, third, fourth, hundredth, wherever it is, do you really believe? No. Because if you really believe, what would you do? You would say, you are the Lord of my life. You are the one that I've confessed when I became a Christian. You're the one that I have pledged to follow regardless of whether I have good or ill all my days. But when a person refuses to do that for whatever reason, and there are examples of that, Luke chapter 12, verses 45 and 46, Jesus there talked about the servant, his Lord was away. And you may remember he began to beat the fellow servants, he began to eat and drink with the drunken. That man was not someone who believed. And he may have thought, well, maybe the master is going to come back someday, but if he really had faith, he would have been faithful. So as we think about this second sin, it is definitely related to the first. And what we're dealing with here really are statements that there has to be faithfulness, there has to be commitment and so forth, and yet sometimes those are the very things that people lack as they supposedly live the Christian life. It can be related, as Glenda mentioned, failure to grow. You have people who are lax in attendance, people who don't come to Bible class. Every congregation struggles with that. I have yet to find an eldership that has been able to solve the attendance problem. You have people that could show up, don't show up. You find people who don't show up, and then you see a Facebook post, well, we were here, we were there when Christians were assembling and so forth. And you have to think, or at least you wonder a little bit, kind of what's going on in the life there, about the commitment. Hebrews 10 has been used a lot of times over the years by preachers to talk about forsaking the assembly. I really think Revelation 21 verse 8 would be a better passage as we think about the unfaithful and even people being spiritual cowards. To tell Christians, look, this is a wake-up call. God says he's got to be the number one priority. He's got to be the one that we're really focused on. Otherwise, we are in danger of being lost. Yes.
And just listen. And learn that way.
A lot of kids. When you think about, several generations ago, kids needed to learn a trade. Before MIT and some other schools came along, you have the, dad is out there welding, or dad's working in the shop, or he's a carpenter. Son goes with him to work. The Amish still, in some ways, follow that. The boys are out there at the shop. Girls are inside with the mom. Here's how we clean house. Here's how we cook food and those kinds of things. And in the spiritual realm, that same kind of thing gets done. Some congregations have formal training classes. We've not done that so much here. But there have been times where we've tried to train our men in some other ways. Here's some things related to the church. I've taken various men in with me as far as benevolent calls. Some of those little things to say, you might not want to handle this on your own at this stage in your life, but this is something that does need to be addressed. Here's an opportunity for you to come along and, kind of like a ride-along with the cop, if you will. You don't want to be the one out there having to handcuff the guy, but at least you can get some insight as far as what's being done. And the same thing can, and in my mind, should be done in the church. Anybody else? Okay, looks like we've got six more sins to go. Abominable is where we want to pick up with next Sunday. Thank you very much.